So that's a very tough act to follow. what I can guarantee you is that the two speakers who are coming after me have actually very dynamic and interesting talks to give tonight. So this is the low point in the evening, but hopefully you still will be awake at the end of my brief presentation. So our topic today that we all are sharing is the vital brain. And so I thought, well, what do I know about the vital brain? It sounds like a bit of a strange question for a neurologist to be asking, but this is, to me, what a picture of a vital brain brings to mind in my mind. And as a neurologist, I'm often faced with and discussing with people who feel that this is the state of their brain. They're coming to me because they have some sort of problem and they don't feel that their brain is working quite as well. But in order to understand and guide them on their journey, I've had to learn from my patients and from reading and from other colleagues what it is that makes our brain vital so that I can understand why sometimes it doesn't work. And so some of the things I've learned are that aging seems to be something that happens on a quite a wide spectrum. And at one end, we have people like Dr. Brenda Milner here, who kind of fortuitously was one of the pioneers in learning how memory works in the brain, and yet at the age of 99 is still supervising graduate students. I think she probably taught both Mark and I in medical school, and still giving TED Talks as of at least 2 years ago. So she would be considered what we call a super ager. On the other hand, we have people who develop conditions like Alzheimer's disease. And really, medical science hasn't answered whether a condition like Alzheimer's disease represents a disease, something that we get from somewhere, the way we get pneumonia from a bacteria, or whether it represents just the opposite end of the superaging spectrum. It's some way in which, for some of us, for unknown reasons, do not age well. And this is really the mystery that we're trying to unravel. But we have learned a few things about why somebody might fall on one end of the spectrum or the other. And so in the scientific literature now, we talk about a concept called brain reserve. And that's really what you're born with, in a sense. Okay, your gender, your genes, the size of your brain, which may be affected by all the things that happened to you in your mother's womb that you had no control over. And so clearly, if you're born with a Ferrari, you're going to have a better chance of making it to the finish line than if you're born with the Lada. But the other emerging concept is something that we call cognitive reserve, meaning if you have two individuals who have relatively comparable brains, some of them seem to weather the storms of aging and even having pathological processes in their brain better than others. And so that's what you do with what you have. And so this has been an interesting area that people have been studying. This is the definition of Marilyn Albert here, the individual differences in lifetime experiences that modify the relationship between brain pathology and cognitive performance. But simpler way to think is just what do you do with what you have? So some of this is well illustrated in a study here that was published 5 years ago, but is a study that was done over 15 years where they tracked people's cognitive performance. These are normal people who did not develop dementia over 15 years, and found that these people fell into three groups. The super agers like Dr. Milner, who maintained or in fact improved their memory performance over the time, an average group that had a little bit of a normal decline in their memory, and then a below average group that had a steeper decline in their memory without really developing outward signs of dementia. And they tried to look at, well, what was it that made it that you fell into one of these groups? And so a lot of people would think, well, it's your genes, it's what you're born with. And to a certain extent, that's true. There were things like gender and genes, which you can't really make much of a decision about once you've had that, or at least sex. But there were things like education and whether you live with someone and the amount of physical activity that helped to determine whether you fell into the superager group or whether you were into the group that had a quicker deterioration. Some other interesting things we've learned is that if you do develop Alzheimer's disease, for example, and you show up at Baycrest, which is where I did my training in Toronto, if you speak a second language, on average, you will develop the Alzheimer's disease 5 years later than somebody who speaks only one language, if you control for every other factor that there is. And that has since been replicated in Morocco and in one center in Europe. So this seems to be a universal thing, that the cognitive exercise of speaking two languages over your lifetime does something to maintain your brain vitality. We see the same thing with music. And so these people here are doing the right thing. So there's this emerging concept of brain maintenance, which is to say, well, let's not wait until there's a problem. What can we do throughout our lives to maintain our brains? The caveat to that, though, is remember there is the brain reserve portion of it. So there are people who do everything right and still have run into trouble as they age. But there are things we can do to put luck on our side to try to maintain our vital brains as we age. And there are thousands and thousands of different scientific publications on the matter now, and I've certainly not even read 0.1% of those. But what I can do is I can distill some of the lessons that I've learned from what I have read and from speaking to colleagues, and so and tell you what I tell people that I work with and run into in everyday life. So lesson number one is that a vital brain is well-fed. And so there are a whole host of nutrients there that are thought to be neuroprotective, but it turns out that putting these into a pill and giving them to people doesn't seem to do as much good as if you take a diet that is rich in all of these things. And so that diet, according to the Consensus Conference on Nutrition in the Brain, which was held, I believe, in Washington a few years ago, is a diet where you substitute a lot of the animal fats for whole grains and fruits and vegetables, a diet where you minimize trans fats, a diet where you take your vitamin E from the diet rather than from supplements. The only supplement advice they gave was that you should supplement your vitamin B12 level if it's low. The other really interesting thing is something that all of our grandparents and their grandparents were telling you is a healthy mind and a healthy body. And so to keep our brains vital, we need to keep our bodies vital. What's interesting in the world of exercise science now is the emerging research on the direct effects of exercise on the brain itself. So we know that when we exercise, our muscles get bigger, our hearts pump faster, but actually there are changes that can be detected at a brain level when we exercise. And I just want to point out this one study because I think it's very cool. This is looking at regions of the brain that are wired together, and in particular they're looking at a network in the brain that we call the default mode network, which is being very heavily studied. And in very broad terms, what the default mode network does is it is on when you're getting ready to engage in an activity. And what's interesting is in Alzheimer's disease, it's one of the connections in the brain that breaks down earliest. The other thing is, as we age, on average, we see deteriorations in the amount of connectivity in our default mode network, and that's what's being shown in the center slide here. These are parts of the default mode network that are more tightly connected together in young people as compared to older people. What they did in this study here is they got older folks who are cognitively healthy to start walking and to stick to a walking plan. And this was the amount of connectivity they had in their default mode network at 0 months. And at 12 months, the group that walked had a much increase in their connectivity compared to the group that was just not told to do anything but what their normal habits are. And what's interesting is the amount of connectivity reached the amount of connectivity in young adults. So there's something about exercise that's good for our brains. It's been shown with resistive exercise like weights and bands. It's been shown with aerobic exercise, and in fact, it may be a combination of both that's optimal. And even a little bit does some good. More is better, but even a little bit does some good. And so at a minimum, people are recommending to do 30 minutes three times a week. If you can get up to an hour three times a week, that's great. If you can get up to an hour a day, that's great. But every little bit counts. Other lesson I've learned from reading is that a vital mind is a healthy mind. And so there are many studies now showing that the presence of clinically significant depression or anxiety in mid or later life leads to accelerated cognitive decline. What we haven't yet been successfully able to show is treating the depression and anxiety reduce that risk of cognitive decline? But I think we can all agree that if we're depressed or anxious, that's not a good thing. So we should be paying attention to our mental health, and if we're having mental health difficulties, we should be able to vocalize that and ask for help. What's very interesting about this whole concept and what's shown in the bottom of this slide here is that even if you don't have clinical depression or clinical anxiety, if you're just a cynical person, that actually increases your risk for dementia. So people who answered this questionnaire and were in the highest group of cynicism had up to a threefold increased risk of developing dementia later in life. Okay, so all of you half glass half empty people, you know, maybe start thinking about changing your thinking patterns here. Another lesson we've learned is that a vital mind is social. Just living with someone, roommate, partner, spouse, reduces your risk of developing dementia by a third. And all social activity has been shown to be beneficial in maintaining brain vitality. And that makes sense because there's actually a lot of cognitive processes that are going on when you're being social, when you're having to think about what the other person is doing. Even if it's just playing board games with your family, you have to think about, well, when would they play those cards? What cards do they have? What card did they play last? And all of these things work to exercise those brain cells. And so this is quite a famous study that was done in Sweden, in Stockholm. It's 10 years old, or 15 years old now, but it's still a pivotal study where they followed a very large group of community-dwelling seniors and tracked their habits over time. And they found that people who do daily social activity or daily mental activity or daily productive activity, as defined here, had a 40% reduction in developing dementia as they were followed on over the years. Okay. So keeping your mind active throughout all phases of life seems to be a good thing for keeping your brain vitality. Again, it's probably something that our grandparents and their grandparents were telling us, but now at least we have science to back it up. And so the one caveat, and I took out a few slides on this because I didn't want to bore you, is that there's lots of companies now that are selling you all sorts of computer games to try to train your mind. And they're good if you want to get better at those computer games. but in my opinion, it's probably better to find a group of neighbors and start a board game club or a card game club than to waste a lot of time on those computer games. That being said, if you're somebody who has mobility trouble, has trouble getting out, has trouble getting inclined to do anything, they can still do some good. It's probably better to do those than to watch TV. But my advice, especially in Victoria, is, you know, sign up for a course at UVic, take a language club, start... break out your old dusty guitar and do those kinds of things. Do something to keep your mind social and busy. Lesson six is a vital mind is a well-rested mind. What this is showing here is a study where they showed that patients who had the least, the third tertile of sleep efficiency, who were the least efficient in their sleep, had the highest amount of proteins that are markers of Alzheimer's disease in their spinal fluid. Now, there's a chicken and an egg thing here. Are they having trouble sleeping because they are developing signs of Alzheimer's disease or vice versa? This study doesn't show it. But since then, there's been a lot of people studying this, and it does seem that one of the roles that we have in sleep is that it's kind of a rinse cycle to clear out some of the junk that is accumulating in our brains as we're using our brains. So getting a good night's sleep throughout life is important, although not always easy. The last lesson I've learned is a vital mind is quiet and knows how to rest and be mindful. And this is going to segue very nicely into Dr. Sherman's talk. People who meditate, we can actually see changes in their brain activation patterns. Here we see increased activation in a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex in patients who have adopted a daily meditation practice. And this busy slide is just to show you that there's a lot of mechanisms now that we're discovering why an ancient practice like meditation might actually be good exercise for your brain. And again, I think Dr. Sherman's going to probably tell us a little bit more about that. So these are the lessons that I've learned from the reading I've done. And they're the lessons I try to pass on to my family members and to my patients. And I think they're there to give us a little bit of hope. We know ways now that we can keep the odds in our favor as we age and as we try to keep our brains vital. And so I think they're important lessons to keep in mind as we continue on with our journeys of life. I'm just going to end with my obligatory slide of my kids saying goodbye to you. And I'll pass it over to Dr. Sherman.